Welcome to Life Science Marketing Radio, the podcast where marketing leaders inside and outside the sciences share their creative ideas and practical approaches to increasing your marketing ROI. Here's your host, Chris Connor.
Thomas Farbhorch is the CEO of Thrive Bioscience. He has founded 17 companies, seven of which have turned out to be unicorns. And today we're going to talk a little bit about all of that and getting innovations to market, maybe why some don't and some secret sauce to that success for people who are looking to be founders. So, Tom, welcome to Life Science Marketing Radio.
Thank you for having me. And thanks for rescheduling this a few times to work around trips and conferences. And glad you came by our booth at Society for Laboratory Automation.
Yeah, so am I. I don't get to meet all my guests in person very often. So for context, I'm interested in your background because I know you didn't just start out founding companies. What were you doing before that? And then tell us a little bit about Thrive Bioscience and what you're doing there.
Sure. So I think I've been starting companies ever since I was at kind of a young age, but I had some really valuable experience with working in larger companies. I ran some small, mid-size public pharmaceutical companies. I worked for a venture capital fund. And, you know, some of those bigger company experiences are really valuable. And it gives you a network of people that that you can go to, and it gives you people that you can learn from. I'm a big fan of putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. That is so often a talent that helps you succeed in understanding if it's a controversy, if it's a negotiation, just doing your job better. So I spent some time as an investor as opposed to, you know, spending most of my life begging for money. I was general partner at a private equity firm, and then I started my own venture capital fund in China with the city of Shanghai as my sole LP. Invaluable experience. I find that most entrepreneurs don't think about the people behind raising money. They might think about it from a customer point of view, but rarely for some reason do they think about what does the investor need? And if they're part of a fund, what are the dynamics that go on? They have partners usually, and you have to think about, you know, about that process. My first job was at Bank of Boston, and I started my first company, first real job. I started my first company while I was there, and with their support. It was actually an AI company. Most of my first half of the companies I started AI companies. I was observant. I think somebody who is inquisitive is somebody who can potentially be a good entrepreneur. I was on the investing side, but because I actually knew how to program an Apple II, they thought that I knew everything, which is, you know, sad. But each time I would go over, there'd be some big mainframe blow-up and a crisis, and the trust accounting system would be down, or the deposits program would be down. And I'd ask, why? You know, we've canceled so many meetings, we've had to end them. And you know, by asking that question, I started my first company, which basically took unstructured COBOL, which is what those programs were written in, and we turned spaghetti code, as it was called, into single entry, single exit modules. So I found being inquisitive and looking where others don't, and especially where others say, oh, no, you can't do that, or that'll never change. So I've started 17 companies before Thrive. Thrive is my 18th. I'm glad to say that I've had seven unicorns, mostly in AI, the combination of AI and life sciences, and in life sciences. I am a generalist. I never went to business school, I don't have any advanced degrees. And I think sometimes that's a benefit. I don't look at things through necessarily, you know, one tunnel. I've had to deal with people who do, who, for instance, just went to business school And we'll say things to board meetings like, well, I learned in business school that span of control shouldn't be more than such and such, and that you have to focus. And a lot of those things, they may not work completely in the real world.
I think being inquisitive, I mean, I always say on this podcast, I had a whole episode on it. Curiosity is a superpower and just
right.
Wanting to know how things work. So tell us a little bit about Thrive Bioscience. What's the principle behind the company, and what got you to start that? What did you see?
Yeah. So between companies is about the only time I get a vacation and also a chance to kind of think and look around. And one of my bosses called it once wandering around in the woods. And you see a path and you take it for a while, and maybe you see it's a dead end. So you go back and you try another path. And I was at that point just before starting Thrive. I was looking for the next company. And I have to say, I always find reading incredibly useful. And airplane rides are, it was difficult during COVID because I didn't have those airplane rides where I would catch up on reading. I read an article about something that was really a bombshell within cell biology and drug development. Amgen had spent 10 years, had up to 100 scientists trying to reproduce 53 landmark preclinical studies. That's a lot of resources. They were only able to reproduce 6. The findings of the others were junk science. That was in 2013. Shortly thereafter, Bayer did a similar study. They could only reproduce 25%, a little bit up from 11%. Now, there have now been multiple studies. None have shown more than 50%. So what that means is 50% of our R&D budgets in life sciences, we're talking about, you know, like $25 billion a year in the U.S., government, pharma, is not correct science. Yet it becomes the basis of very expensive clinical development programs, drug development programs. It actually goes into humans, which is scary. So, right. You know, many of these drugs that really are not based on good science are putting people at risk when they go into trials. And obviously, the percentage of success is tiny. And so that's what really interested me, because there were some really good articles around the same time and some studies that were done on the cost of drug development. And so I did more reading, and it turned out that about half of the failures were related to cell culture and things around cell culture. Cell culture is the basis of almost all life science research. It starts with the cell. And I went and visited, because I was curious, a cell culture lab. And the person who invited me also invited Alan Blanchard, who is now my co-founder. I was horrified. It's undigitized. There's almost no data. It's manual processes. It's been done the same way for 70 years. That reminded me a lot of one of my previous companies, Cytek, where we automated cytology labs. Pap smears had been done the same way for 65 years. Whenever I hear that or see that, to me, that means people have stopped thinking. Especially if they say something like, in the case of pap smears, they say, oh, you'll never change professional health providers' behavior. They've been doing it for all that time. But pap smears were one of the least accurate tests, but it was the world's most widely given primary screening test. And its accuracy was around 70%. And we automated cytology labs. We brought tools, databases, actually artificial intelligence. We didn't talk about it. Many of my companies have used AI, and it's just a technique. We didn't define ourselves that way. But we completely changed the face of cervical cancer. We got 90% market share in the U.S. and high market share elsewhere. Company was acquired for $6 billion. And I saw a repeat. This time is cell culture labs rather than cytology labs. But in cytology, you have people that are looking at microscope slides, basically stained cells, all day. hundreds of them, looking for a needle in a haystack. And there's no documentation, no tools. And cell culture was almost the same, a little bit different, much bigger, because it's the basis of almost all life sciences, not regulated except certain segments related to medical or as you get closer to, closer to clinical. No tools, ignored, so it met, you know, checked a lot of boxes. And so I saw it as a repeat. I was lucky to meet my co-founder. I've worked with many, the best one out of 30 or 40 that I've had. He had built the first sequencers with Lee Hood and continued to develop, you know, many of them. And he looked at it as, I've spent 25 years producing data for genomics. So sequencing changed the field of genomics. I mean, it wasn't quite as bad as just Mendel's peas, but
right.
But there were not a lot of tools there.
And computations as part of that, right?
That's right. And so he, for 25 years, had you know, basically produced instruments that provided huge data sets that could be mined, that were reproducible. And he saw that cell biology was lacking this. And you know, it is harder. It's more difficult, actually, than sequencing. Sequencing, yeah, DNA is a chemical. It's dead. So we wanted to produce huge data sets about the cell that, in my case, I'd been in pharma. I'd run some pharmaceutical companies. I particularly wanted to try and change the odds of drugs getting to people as, you know, as medicines. And all the problems start right at cell culture. So we started Thrive with the vision of producing the kind of data sets that can be mined, that can allow for breakthrough insights, but also undo the problems in cell culture. Mislabeling rates are frightening. Depending on the studies that you look at, it's like 11% to 32% of the cells, the cell lines that are being studied are incorrectly labeled. And what that means is you might be screening a set of compounds on what you think is a line of liver cancer, but it's actually a pancreatic cell line. And so no wonder we have these, you know, poor rates of success. Also, things aren't documented. There's cross-contamination. And then we keep these cells in incubators that are dumb. They don't monitor. We have to go in and knock plates in order to get ours. That plate crosses multiple environments. Researchers spend 2.5 hours a day looking at these plates, put them back in the incubator after causing contamination and stressing them. And guess what? There's no data. No data has been kept in 99% of the labs. Uber knows more about us than we know about those cells, truly. And yet this is the basis of, you know, drug discovery and drug development. So that is what we're going to fix, and we are fixing, with incredible live cell imaging, with automation, with documentation. And we're really the first company that is creating the kind of extensive time series comparable data sets, non-biased, as in we take pictures of all the cells in all the wells. We do it at 100 focal planes. You need those kinds of data sets, just like genomics needed sequencing, so that you can improve the processes. Because if you're not measuring it, you don't know, right? So our objectives are, with this data, improve the processes, help our customers to improve the processes. Number two, we actually started the company just thinking we're going to improve cells and make sure that they're well-documented and they're not stressed. They're actually close to the patient model. You know, they're supposed to be a model of us. But what we found was that this data was incredibly useful to researchers, making breakthrough insights. And the third use of these databases that our customers are creating, they don't even know it yet. But our future products are a series of automation products. And those databases are going to drive automation. It's intelligent automation. It's going to use AI in many cases. So IA from AI. the system has to have more automation. So that's why we founded. That's what we want to accomplish.
I think all that, it's all fascinating. I think a lot about the challenge of how many drugs fail in clinical trials, 90% or whatever. And could you take a swing at a number or just give your thoughts on this? So either we've hit all the easy targets and there aren't very many left, or there are problems aside from choosing targets and there's other parts of the system that are really the problem, as the one you just described. I mean, I'm just trying to think about, I always wonder, are there other things we could be attacking besides trying to find, but using AI to model and find better targets and small molecules?
So sadly, but maybe there's room for optimism in there. Probably experiments that have been done for the last 50 years that involve cell culture should probably be redone. And we see time and time again examples, real examples that you can't refute, you can't walk away from, where because they were using our instrument, they were getting different answers. And therefore, a lot of targets, a lot of things that were done, were thought to work, and then we find that many of them don't, a very high percentage don't, because it was built on a shaky foundation. Sadly, there are so many targets that were thought that were ignored, it didn't work. So you have kind of both extremes. So what happens in early stage research is the scientific process is that you want to have the same thing happen twice. You want the same result twice. Well, the problem is you do it 5 times, 6 times, 7 times with something that's completely uncontrolled and no data. And so you get 2 flukes and you declare victory. And so we have a lot of cases where we're really almost seeing more the artifacts of the way things were done than, you know, the actual real thing. And then there's the other side of it, where we're missing things. So there's an incredible amount of discovery that can happen. I'll give you an example. Most cell counters are inaccurate. Knowing the number of cells is fundamental to many important workflows, experiments, and assays. You might be measuring the number of cells that have died as a result of a drug. One of the main uses of cell counting is to see how many cells survived as a result of your therapy. And yet they're off by 40 to 80%. This is kind of one of those little dirty secrets that most people know. It's very inaccurate. You can count them manually, but that's not scalable. This is an example of why cell culture has to be done better. Live cell counters are everywhere, and they tell you how many live cells and they tell you how many dead cells. Well, not only are they inaccurate, anybody who knows anything about biology knows, yeah, there are live cells, there are dead cells, and there's cells in between. And there's a lot of data in that. So what a drug maybe doesn't kill them, but maybe they're zombie cells and you've actually accomplished. So just we're bringing data, we're bringing documentation, we're bringing history. We can track. We are better than any other instrument, not only able to do in 3D, we can track single cells over time. And so these data sets that we have, the instrument is closer to the biology. It's not just a better microscope. What is biology? Well, it doesn't happen in 2D. It happens in dimensions. It happens over time. It's often a process. These experiments are affected by the environment, so we control the environment. So what we've really done is develop live cell imaging and analytics that have the cell in mind. In many ways, a microscope doesn't. It's convenient for the user. And frankly, anybody who's looking through an objective is doing it the wrong way, in my view. That's we can do in the digital world better than we can in the analog world.
So at the top, you mentioned, and this is related to this, getting people to change how they do things. And you and I, when we met at the cell biology meeting, said science is hard. People are more so. But when people have been doing things for 70 years, even though you've got better results and an easier process for them, how do you get them to just say, all right, I'm gonna change up everything I do?
You asked me that question, and we talked about it at Society for Laboratory Automation and Screening. And I like to think that I can come up with good answers to a lot of questions. This one's a tough one, but incredibly important. And I've been lucky to be part of companies like Cytek, where we changed the way pap smears were done.
Right.
Exact Sciences, where we changed the way colonoscopies are done. It's never easy. There are multiple factors that usually, I believe, are needed to occur in order to get people to change. And at a general level, because obviously the field, et cetera, matters. But people are trying to accomplish something. And perhaps it's publish or perish, or it's, to have a successful drug. If you can provide them a leg up in this very competitive world, and all segments of life sciences are competitive, whether it's academia or industry, you can create a kind of a competitive environment. And there are still barriers. There are some people who just aren't going to change. But when researchers read other researchers' papers, and they read them really carefully, and they read the methods section really carefully, and then they see that there is something being done that can either leave them behind or give them a leg up, many will adapt. Not all, right? Because there are early adopters. So how do you get the late adopters? Well, they care about sometimes slightly different things. There is some overlap. So in the case of cell culture, there's very little documentation and almost no market penetration by electronic laboratory notebooks into the cell culture lab. And lab managers, senior researchers, funders of research, sometimes it's pharmaceutical company, publishers, the journals, do care about the answers and having quality answers. And so they can provide pull, but you can also do things that in the product appeal to them. So it sounds incredibly boring, but we develop and have the best documentation system for cell culture labs. It's not rocket science. It's a barcode scanner, which, by the way, gets oohs and ahs in many cell culture labs because they literally have no technology. And we have customers that put these simple barcode stickers on the shelf, the incubator where the plate is, the hood that they used, the top of the plate, the bottom of the plate, because these plates, the tops get mixed up and often written on a Sharpie. So documentation, though, appeals a lot to senior researchers who often feel they don't know what's going on in their lab, who are themselves kind of overwhelmed with data, are not able to go back and look at things. But we allow we allow them, when an experiment works or doesn't work, to know why, or at least have a lot of information. We can increase yield. We can reduce errors. So we appeal as well to the lab manager. I also mentioned creating pull. So the journals have been embarrassed by incorrect research. And they've read some of the articles that have appeared in their journals, in Nature, that have said that about 43% of non-reproducible data relates to cell culture. And they have read the papers that crossing multiple environments stresses the cells, it changes the ones that can survive. And so a large group of them got together and increased the requirements for what information they have to provide before they're going to publish an article. And a huge number of them have to do with cell culture and things like, you know, what type of them did you use? What kind of controls were there? We have pharmaceutical companies that are customers that want their CROs, their contract research organizations, to have the same equipment, because what we give them is a platform for collaboration, because we're producing comparable data. It's a bad word to use in life science, but part of getting change is to have something that goes viral. Bad word. Yeah. But the concept is important, which is the more somebody is using the instrument, there are more people who want to or need to use it. So I've been thinking about the question you asked. Those are only a few answers. I know there are better answers on how to get people to change. And it's really, it's worthy of a book. It's worthy of, a lot of study. And it is to some extent, but it's not explicitly looked at often. If you hadn't asked me the question, I wouldn't have thought about it as much. And it's a good thing to think about. Yeah. Some of the early adopters, later adopters, that information is certainly helpful. And innovative companies do have to typically find, the early adopters. Many early stage companies, and I've gotten to see 18, and as an investor, see many more. They have a pretty good plan for the early adopters, and they're able to relate to them. And then they fall down on being able to communicate with those other groups or find what's important to them, like payback, like documentation, things like that. And it's often the things that we think of in startups as mundane and not the exciting stuff. And investors, it's not shiny enough for them, but it takes a different mindset to get beyond that, the early adopters.
The things that stood out to me there, one, when at the beginning, you're talking about people's sort of long-term goals, their competitive status or, and the things they're trying to achieve. And then on the other end of it are the not shiny things, maybe a barcode. I don't know if you consider it shiny or not, but
not really.
Right. So the investors or whoever might look at it and go, well, that's not the coolest thing. Everybody has that, but they don't. Right. Yeah. I mean, and I'm just saying, we all live in a world now where if I order something from Amazon or eBay, every day I can find out where in the country that thing is. If I order it from Boston, where you are, I know when it got to Indiana and Utah and here. And so to think like we should know where our cells were and where that plate was, in which incubator.
Yeah, we
the
don't.
Guy shows up at your door, he's got a scanner. That's all it takes. Look, it's here.
Yeah. So I said Uber knows more about us than we know about these cells. Another great example, Amazon knows more about their packages than we do. There's a lot of technology out there that is so part of the problem, I think, Chris, is silos. The problem with silos is you're trying to solve new problems bigger problems, sometimes the same problem, with the same mindset, the same technology, the same approach. And I've always, almost all my companies are at the intersection of several fields. So Thrive, we're really a data company and we're an AI company, but we're first focusing on, you have to have the data. And until somebody does that, but it's also very valuable to own that data. But part of an investor sometimes understand this, but often not. When they ask, you know, what are the barriers to entry to Thrive? Well, one of them is to solve this problem. And I like problems like this. It's multifactorial. It does take multiple disciplines. So we're combining optical engineering, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, fluidics, AI, and different parts of AI, such as machine learning, image processing, database technology, UI, UX, and biologists. And it's hard enough to have hardware and software people talking to each other and designing products together. It takes, in the case of life sciences, you got to keep the user in mind. And so many times, we went through an exercise. We spent the first like year and a half talking to labs, asking them about their problems. And you know, that's an incredibly, incredibly valuable exercise to go through. Again, it sort of, you know, makes you put yourself in the other person's shoes. But so often we would hear, we'd ask about the instrument and they would say, oh, it's a really good instrument. But obviously they never talked to a biologist when they designed it. And so we're doing our best to do that. And I think we do it far better than other companies. And so, you know, silos. So I think part of the answer to your question, although we started a different question, part of the answer to earlier question about changing behavior, you have to have the right solutions. And if you're restricting yourself to kind of what you know, that's going to lead to a less optimal solution. And unfortunately, it's almost always harder to raise money when you have a company that is crossing boundaries and doesn't fit into, you know, kind of their pigeonhole.
Right. So now we're going to shift gears. Are you okay on time? Because we have a few more questions on shifting from the technology side over to sort of the founder side. And we had an earlier conversation about someone has a certain idea and they think they want to start a company, or they're the person who has an idea and says, I'm not the person to start a company. How should people evaluate that? And then we can talk about investors and boards and so on.
So you mentioned, you know, founders and starting companies. And you would think that every investor, before they invest in Thrive, and we've raised $40 million from a lot of fantastic family offices like Louders, KP Chow family, and some great life science angel groups, such as Life Science Angels and Sidecar. And interestingly, the family offices are often, it's often funds from somebody who ran a business. And so they understand often how difficult it is. They've had bad experience with a partner, you know, business partner or something like that. And they'll often ask about it. But it still amazes me how many people don't focus on that. Almost nobody has ever asked Alan or me, do you guys get along? How do you communicate with each other? Or when they're talking to employees and they don't ask about it. But if the founders are not getting along, haven't figured out how to get along, it'll blow up the whole company. It'll just create, you know, huge problems. And so it's really important that you pick the right founder. I would say I also, when I'm investing in a company or starting a company, it's good to have more than just two founders, because along the way, things shift. You're likely to pivot. Your skills change. And it, for at least in companies I've been in, rarely do all the founders survive. In part because they weren't necessarily right for what the business became, or as you thought through. It is helpful to have a number of founders with different skill sets at the at the table. So I'm more of the business guy. Alan is the brilliant guy, incredible engineer, software, hardware, neural networks across across the board. It's almost always critical to success, I believe, to have a business person and a research-oriented scientific person, technology person, who can get along and do get along and respect each other. I think somebody who is starting it on their own, we talked about who should start companies, how. It's really helpful to have people to talk to. And I have seen, now that I think about it, actually, I do coach a lot of people because I was coached. So I'd like to give back. And those people coach me without knowing whether there'd be any return or whatever. And so I do that a lot. And I do see a lot of single entrepreneurs with an idea, and they're going to go try raise money and develop it, and they have nobody to talk to. They don't have that perspective. And then you see a team. It's generally a completely different level of sophistication. And so somebody starting a company, now you got to pick the right ones. And you don't have to, by the way, immediately make somebody a founder, or give them equity ownership. You work with somebody for a while and develop a founding team. I think that's really, really important for success in starting companies.
So you mentioned, let's talk about investors, because you might have a mix of investors. It sounds like you've got a good mix, but I can imagine there are times when different groups of investors may not have the same timelines and same goals. And so when you have to pivot, how do you keep them all in sync and on the same page? And
I think number one, asking the question itself is important, because many entrepreneurs don't think about, or they learn by making mistakes, that they haven't put themselves in the shoes of their investors. Always something incredibly important to be able to think about things the way somebody you work with or somebody you accept money from. And so they don't pay attention to that. And also, a lot of times you have to raise money and you have to stay at the table, and not everybody has the luxury of saying no. But I also think that people don't think explicitly enough about that. So we have a large number of family offices and angel groups. And a lot of that is because there are very few venture capitalists that love this area. So we are just finishing up our Series B convertible note with $15 million, and we've raised a total of 40, including that. And our next financing is in 6 months or so, and it's our Series B. And given the size of what we want, and we are interested in making acquisitions, so having an institutional firm that's able to put more money in, for a lot of reasons, it fits. But interestingly, I had two of my largest investors, incredibly well-known families. One wanted to see me in person. The other wanted to have a long phone call. And they raised the issue of the potential for lack of compatibility in the investor and at the board level. And their concern is that the objectives of a institutional investor, a venture investor, they have a fund and they have certain incentives. They're, on one hand, if you if one of these institutional investors makes an investment, and you tell them the next day, I'll pay 50% above, I'll buy your shares for 50% more. Incredible return, right? 50% in a day. Most would say, no, my job is to build companies and get to 10x the investment. And some of that is because, well, they get management fees as long as they have that money. As soon as they cash out, they're not getting a management fee. And the amount that they get is based on the profit. And so they want to see not a small amount of profit quickly. I'm generalizing here a little bit, but yeah. A large amount. So we are facing this problem. And I think the answer is not all venture capital or institutional firms are the same. I mean, it's not sour grapes because I've raised hundreds of million, but there are big differences in the personality, you know, et cetera. Most entrepreneurs don't give that a lot of thought. And so, you know, basically my two largest family investors said, Tom, you need to give this thought. And they were right. And so asking the question is part of what you have to do. And so we're going to be, you know, very attuned to the type of fund and to make sure that there's a degree of compatibility between them.
Yeah. Okay, I want to finish up with two questions, if we have time. One, what makes a good board of directors? You and I had a nice conversation about that. And then the last question is I'll frame it, your near-death experiences with all your unicorns.
The board of directors is one of my favorite topics. It's so incredibly important. Many entrepreneurs don't spend enough time focusing on compatibility across the board and kind of the profile of what they want. You know, interestingly, so I call it a Hollywood board when you have somebody who is just there to impress people, is maybe a big name, you know, and Theranos is probably a great example of it. You know, besides being a red flag, it's not helpful. But at the same time, probably the best director I ever had, it's a surprising name for most people, was General Alexander Haig. And he was on the board of this public pharmaceutical company, somewhat for, I believe, I didn't select him. It turns out he was phenomenal as a board member. And did he really understand pharmaceutical industry? No. But he had a set of talents that almost nobody else had. And I have found that every board needs somebody like him who was process-oriented, who would keep discussions going, would make sure that everybody was heard, would make sure that that discussion is limited and that there is a decision made. And part of his talent was his ability to read a room and body language. I was in a board meeting. It was actually my first. I had something I really wanted to say. It contradicted what others, including my boss, were saying. And I was thinking, you know, what am I going to do about this? You know, do I bring it up? Do I maybe bring it up later? Is there a tactful way? And all of a sudden, General Haig turns to me and says, you know, Tom, what do you think of this, this, and this? And I felt like he was reading my mind. And it gave me the cover to, you know, to bring up those issues, which were important. I later asked him, or I told him, I said, you know, the first time I met you, it was really remarkable. You literally like read my mind, you know, was that chance? He said, no, I knew that you had something important to say. And I said, well, how'd you know that? And he said, well, you went like this. even more subtly than I just did it. I couldn't even see what he was. He said, "You moved your lips slightly a couple of times." And I said, "I didn't even know you were looking at me." Well, you know, the guy ran NATO for over a decade, dealing with different countries, et cetera. So sorry for the long story, but you know, process is important. And yes, it is important that you have on the board domain knowledge, but it's not everything. It's really helpful to have board members who have been on the other side, have had board members themselves, and are familiar with some of those, you know, those kinds of frustrations. And some of it is really the personal characteristics of the person. One of the best ways to get a board member is start with a different kind of relationship with them. It can be an informal kind of mentoring. I've had several, including a current board member, Brock Reeve, who was executive director of the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. He was on our scientific advisory board, and we got to know him and then asked him to be on the board. Try before you buy is always, you know, is a good policy. But very important lesson, Chris, because most of my companies have been venture funded. And again, many entrepreneurs don't understand how those partnerships work. It's really important that an entrepreneur have in their agreements that who's going to be on their board. What you don't want to have happen is a partner gets busy and they're sending an associate. And, you know, they're under a lot of pressure, and a lot of times, you know, they can't. But if you have rules that they have to be there for 3 quarters, and otherwise you can, you know, replace them. Oftentimes, you end up starting with one partner, and maybe that person leaves, maybe he gets busy, and you end up with another partner, and the entrepreneur hasn't negotiated any, you know, even if it's in good faith, an ability to decide on that person. I also think generally having a large number of venture capitalists on the board, unless they have industry experience, which many do, companies often well served to say, okay, venture fund, you want 2 people representing you. Well, but one of them has to be from industry, and we'll compensate them, you know, as a board member, and they might know they report to you, but we don't want to end up with, you know, just investors on our board.
Right.
So I hope those are some helpful tips for other entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I appreciate, all of that for sure. You want, you know, some broad knowledge, of course, right? You don't want to be, as we started at the beginning, have everyone have a narrow view of what needs to happen. I like the process description you gave of General Haig. I think I mentioned this to you in our previous conversation. What struck me, the similarities, I have a friend who's a general in the Air Force, and I said, how'd you get to be a general? Because he's the most down-to-earth guy you'd ever meet. And he said, I was never the smartest person in the room, but I knew who was. And it sounds, mm-hmm. you know, like General Haig has that skill of being able to see who knows what, make yep. sure everybody gets to speak up, and then come to an answer.
Yep. I've seen that in other boards, too. Missing that person can lead to a lot of meandering, poor decision-making, you know, et cetera.
Okay, so you told me that every one of your unicorns came close to death
many
at some
times.
Point. So what did you learn from that? I mean, you can give an example or just what the overall takeaway is, because I'm sure everybody faces that and goes, oh, my gosh, we're cooked. And yet right. you got through it.
So I think you and I, you came by our booth at Society for Laboratory Automation and Screening, and I think you pointed out, it was a big show, and I think you pointed out, look at all these companies with innovations. And you said something like, you know, but how many of them are going to make it? And sadly, there are so many innovations that will never come back because the people who were running that company weren't able, you know, not always their fault, weren't able, you know, to keep it going. And so being able to stay at the table is incredibly important. So one of the things that I learned is, I mean, yes, you need things like resilience. You need you need passion, because you're going to have hurdles. You need to be a really good problem solver. And actually, there's a theme here. A lot of these are personal attributes, and maybe some of the what people would consider the softer side. When you're in a crisis, that is when if you're all those personality issues are important. And so somebody who doesn't take feedback, isn't coachable, doesn't ask for help, is going to have a hard time surviving. Also, somebody who doesn't take care of themselves, because your frame of mind at that time is incredibly important. And fear is a terrible advisor. So I think a lot of times it's actually personal characteristics. I've sat, you know, in many companies in a dark room because payroll was going to hit the account in the morning and I didn't have the money. And coming up with a solution wasn't from fear. It was from problem solving, a certain amount of optimism, just thinking how, who. Now, it's not all personal characteristics. Obviously, having a team is important. Having the right investors. So, at Sitech, we had a fantastic set of big name venture firms, and then we had a regulatory disaster. And we basically had to redo our trials for a reason. There was a person who had been a regulatory person for us who had made some mistakes and we weren't aware of them. And the company rarely do investors give you a year full of money or 2 years. And what happened was our investors abandoned us. They wrote us off. Okay, this is a company that sold later for $6 billion. And there was one investor, bless his heart, who would come once a week, sometimes more often, and would sit down with us and brainstorm and help us. Everyone else, they basically looked at it as, I have to optimize my portfolio. I think investing in this company doesn't have a great chance. And so, I'm going to focus. And then when one of them does it, they all do it. That is when it's incredibly important to have incredible investors that are in the guardian angel, kind of category. So I guess what I've learned is your own set of personal characteristics. It's a lot about you. The founders or the CEO, how well the founders get together, all these kind of soft things in a moment of crisis, it's personalities and things like that that can actually make the difference. It's not necessarily, I mean, you need that to come up with the answer, but it's often not because of a market shift. Yes, it is, but the survival doesn't have to do with things often that are outside the company. It's what you're going to do. And having great advisors and being the kind of person that asks for feedback and wants it. It's not always easy to do. Also, I mentioned some of these things, asking for help. So every one of them died or came close to dying, two, three, four times. And it's then when doing having done things right, and being in a, you know, healthy, you know, mentally, physically, having great founders, having great investors, interacting, asking for help, all these kind of soft things that, you know, a lot of people look at, you know, it's all about, you know, raising more money. Well, you're going to have a hard time raising money if you don't have the ability to figure out, and investors can tell, like if you're scared or if you, you know, you don't have an answer. So the sad thing is that so many great, you know, great companies, great ideas will never be known because that company wasn't able, you know, to stay at the table. Having a good board, all the things we've talked about, you know, if everything's going right, it may not matter. General Haig was us through really difficult times. It's easy to be not have things in place and survive during good times, but the cracks show during the bad times. And so doing things right is important, and it's cumulative. It's a hard question to answer.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. I mean, I think the overall theme, first of all, thank you so much for being so generous with your time today and all your insights. I mean, there are opportunities to be had by thinking differently about technology. And then once you've done that, there are still challenges in thinking about how you interact with people and who you choose to interact with if you're going to be a successful founder. I think that, for me, is the first line takeaway, at least.
Yeah. Well, listen, a lot of the answer is having the right question. And thanks for asking some great, great questions. And I'll be thinking about answers to your questions for a long time. So I might email you.
That would be fantastic. And of course, I'm going to share this on LinkedIn. I'll share, you know, a link to Thrive at least and your LinkedIn profile. But yeah, if you come up with some other answers, you can comment on the posts and add some afterthoughts.
I will. Thank you so much, Chris. Thank you for the wonderful questions and for the opportunity to talk with you in depth.
My pleasure.